You're listening to Friendly Connections, the podcast of the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. I'm Chase Maxwell. This episode features the first installment of Visions of Courage, the second year of our Women's History Lecture Series, presented by historian Jill Zahnheiser. I'm excited to announce that we'll be providing the entire series as a podcast this year, so stay tuned for the next three episodes. You can find these episodes on thefriends.org/podcast or on iTunes when they become available. Jill Zahnheiser is an independent scholar who holds a PhD from the University of Iowa. She has taught at the Universities of Iowa and Minnesota, St. Cloud State University, and the University of Wisconsin River Falls. Dr. Zahnheiser is the co-author of the recent book, Alice Paul, Claiming Power, and the author of the And Then She Said series of quotations by women. In this episode, Professor Zahnheiser discusses the life and legacy of Harriet Tubman. Myths about her persist, but the realities of her life are even more fascinating. Throughout the presentation, Professor Zahnheiser refers to a series of visuals included in a PowerPoint presentation. This presentation and a suggested reading list is available to view on thefriends.org/courage. We encourage you to download these visuals before listening. Finally, thank you for listening to Friendly Connections. Without any further ado, here's episode one of Visions of Courage.
I'm so happy to see so many people here tonight, and as Bailey said, some familiar faces from the series that we did last year. We made, in talking with Bailey and her supervisor, Elaine Hopkins, at the Friends about the series last year, we decided to make a couple changes. One is that there were so many good questions last year, I decided to make the talks a little shorter so we could have more time for questions and kind of get into areas that you're specifically interested in. So hopefully that will go over well. And the second thing that we decided to do was add a little more local Minnesota flavor to the series. We really didn't have very much last season, but with the exception of the program tonight, and even that, I'll mention some connections of the Underground Railroad with St. Paul. The presentation next week about the suffrage movement is specifically about what went on in Minnesota, which was quite different than what was going on in the national movement, even though obviously they're connected. And then the third presentation on the emergence of the women's movement, re-emergence of the women's movement in the 1970s, will have some local content. And then the last presentation about Mexican women is specifically about Mexican women in Minnesota. So we'll have a few more local connections for those of you interested in local history. I was thinking tonight might be our largest audience because Harriet Tubman has been enjoying a cultural moment this year with the incredible publicity which has accompanied the campaign to get women on the money. So if you've been following the Women on the 20s and now Women on the 10s campaign, Harriet Tubman was at the top of the list, people voting about who should be the woman, first woman on the on our paper money. She was at the top of that list by far, and the final decision has not been made yet by the Treasury Department, but is it expected soon? And I wouldn't be at all surprised if it is Harriet Tubman. So she's been having a little bit of reemergence, but whenever you start talking about Harriet Tubman and start talking about the Underground Railroad, you're talking not only about history, but you're talking about memory. And historians have become more and more interested in memory in the last 20 years. And I think this is something you can all relate to. If you've ever talked to your siblings, your sister or brother, or perhaps an aunt or uncle about something that happened 20 years ago, and you say what you think happened, and then the second person says what she or he thinks happened, you notice there's a significant difference. And that's what has intrigued historians about a number of things, including our memory, our historical memory, our collective historical memory of Harriet Tubman, our collective memory of the Underground Railroad. The memory of Harriet Tubman has waxed and waned in popularity. It might not surprise you that we became very interested in Harriet Tubman about the time of the Civil Rights Movement. We became interested in African-American history in general, but particularly Harriet Tubman. This is when we begin to see a lot of books about her, biographies about her for younger children, and her story became a fixture of elementary school classrooms. And this is why everybody in the country knows who Harriet Tubman is, because they all talked about her and the Underground Railroad in elementary school. It's also interesting, however, that there had not been an adult biography of Harriet Tubman since 1943, and before that, since the late 19th century. So that gives you a sense that our interest in her, as our interest in any topic, has waxed and waned, depending on what else is going on in the country. As I said, with this Women on the Money campaign, her name has reemerged in a big way, and people are talking about her a bit more now. So I'm going to be talking about when you have a topic like Harriet Tubman, the Underground Railroad. These are things, Harriet Tubman did a lot of dangerous things in her life, and she did a lot of things that she could not talk about very much. The Underground Railroad was a secret activities, and nobody talked about them except very, very privately until after the Civil War, because they would be in danger if they did. Because of this, not a lot was written down. We have very few documents about the activities of what was called the Underground Railroad. Harriet Tubman could not read or write, and so we really have nothing from her that's written directly from her. We have nothing, all we have is reported speech, you know, what she said at a woman's suffrage meeting, what she said at an abolition meeting, what she told someone else. So we have nothing directly from her. So this means they're just fertile ground for a lot of myths and exaggerations and misunderstandings about both Harriet Tubman and the Underground Railroad. So we're going to try to, as they say, unpack a few of those tonight. I'll be using, because we don't really have any photographs of Harriet Tubman much before the end of the Civil War for the same reasons, I'm using a lot of the images, artistic images of her, which have proliferated through the 20th century. And this is an image done by an artist, William H. Johnson, in 1945. And we'll talk about the two photographs that this is taken from later on in the presentation. But you see Harriet here with a gun, and this is something that became very contested in the picture that this was taken from, the North Star above her head. Harriet Tubman has not been neglected as an historical figure really throughout American history. These are images of only two of quite a few statues that there are around the country, mostly in the Northeast, but also in places like Arkansas, in Ohio, in a number of states around the country. The one on the to your right is in Wilmington, Delaware. See Harriet, and then we see Thomas Garrett also included in the statue. He was the chief, he was a Quaker who was sort of what they called the chief person at the Underground Railroad in the Wilmington area. And then on the left, an image, another image of Harriet Tubman in the Boston area. But there are, I would say, 8 or 10 statues around the country. Just last year, President Obama designated the area that Harriet Tubman grew up in as a slave on the eastern shore of Maryland as something that was going to be developed in the Harriet Tubman National Historic Park. And there's a 17,000-acre area that's sort of the monument area, and then there's going to be a specific park developed. We'll talk about where she settled in Auburn, New York, in the Finger Lakes region in upstate New York, which just this year has been an historic site for quite a while. They've been struggling, but kind of a small group of people trying to maintain that. And just this year, the National Park Service has decided to include that among its historic sites. So I expect that to be developed, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. So she is pretty well represented among the public art and the historic sites around the country. Some of the myths about Harriet Tubman have to do with where she was born, even? And this is something that we encounter with many African Americans who began their lives as enslaved people, that the records available, birth certificates and things like that that we take for granted, just are not available. And so very few, and this is even true of poor whites in the 19th century, birth dates sort of fuzzy. You know, very few people really knew when they were born, and sometimes not even where. But we were never quite sure until recently where Harriet Tubman was born. The number of missions that she took for the Underground Railroad, you see many, many different figures about that. Again, these are dangerous missions, things that people didn't talk about. And so this is part of the reason that we have that. And also, some of the numbers were knowingly inflated for reasons I'll talk about later. The number of people also that she brought in these missions. And then the idea of there were rewards for a whole raft of fugitive slaves, even if they weren't carrying people actually out of the South. And the question of how much reward was offered for Harriet Tubman's capture has been out there as well. Fortunately, after having no adult biography of Harriet Tubman since 1943, in the last 10 years, somehow something took hold, and we've had three quite good ones in the last 10 years, and also a book, and these are all on your reading list, a book which really picks apart these myths and where they started and what, you know, what we know now, whether we've solved the question of what exactly happened or how many people there were, how many missions. So we're in a very, very good position now historically in terms of people who have really run down this information. So we'll talk about what they found out. But first we need to talk a little bit about the Underground Railroad. And I like this map because it gives you a sense of how many possibilities slaves had if they were thinking about running away. However, if you're talking about somebody, if you notice this map, you notice that how many of these routes go along the waterways. And we see Minnesota, of course, is not a state until into the 1850s. But we did have a few people coming up the Mississippi River. There was one steamboat that there was a connection on, someone who lived in St. Paul. There were only about 50 African Americans in St. Paul around 1850. But we did have a few people coming up the Mississippi River and through connections in St. Paul making their way to Canada, of course, which wasn't very far. But the rivers were, there were a lot of free black seamen working the Mississippi, working the Chesapeake Bay and the rivers in Maryland, working the Ohio River. And this was one way that not only fugitives were carried, but information was transferred back and forth. It was part of the kind of an intricate information network. Most slaves that escaped, and to give you a sense of the numbers, by 1865, there were 4 million slaves in the South, 4 million. The highest estimate for the number that actually escaped is 100,000, and that's the very high estimate. So we're talking about a very, very, very small percentage of people who both had the courage and the means, the information and the raw courage to get themselves out of an enslaved situation. And if you can look at this map again, you can probably guess that there weren't too many people in the depths of Alabama, slaves who made their way up through the Appalachian Mountains to the north. Slaves that escaped mostly went to the closest place that they could go where they could either disappear or where they would be in free territory. So you have people in the border areas here in Kentucky going across the Ohio River into Ohio or into Indiana. You had a lot of slaves in Maryland. We think of Frederick Douglass, who comes from the same area as Harriet Tubman, working the waterways here, finding passage through the waterways and on the trains up into Pennsylvania, into Philadelphia. Lots of fairly high percentage of the slaves who did escape came from Maryland for that reason. Slaves who were living down in these areas were going to other places. They might try to get away from the United States completely if they could get to the Gulf of Mexico. New Orleans was a great place to disappear because there were New Orleans history had been held by the Spanish, the French. It was really a polyglot city. There were a lot of free blacks there as well. It was an easy place to disappear. So we have a lot of people going to New Orleans. So you got to the closest place you thought you could go. Rather than thinking strictly of slaves escaping, it's probably more accurate to think of the idea of escaping kind of on a continuum. If you weren't too sure about, and keep in mind, slaves were not permitted to read or write. And many of them, particularly in the Deep South where there were plantations, really had not been off that plantation, possibly since they were born, unless it was to a nearby cemetery, a nearby church. So directions were a big issue. One of the myths about the Underground Railroad is this notion of the song followed the drinking gourd, that everybody knew that, and so they followed those directions. Completely untrue. Follow the Drinking Gourd was written in 1943. So, need we say more? However, the North Star, a lot of them knew the North Star. That is accurate. So a lot of people thought about just, their initial thought was to get away. It might have been an impulse. And so they stay away from in the same area because they don't really quite know where to go, you know, for a few days or for a week. And then they come back and take the consequences. And that might have been a first trial. And maybe then they go away for a little bit longer, somewhere nearby where they can get food, where people would help them, either other slaves or free blacks in the area. And then maybe they try to go to a nearby city a little bit further. Maroon colonies, particularly in the Deep South, were a definite option. A maroon colony was really an independent settlement in the middle of nowhere, literally. I mean, in a swamp, the Great Dismal Swamp, North Carolina, Virginia was one of the largest. And these are just refugee colonies, people who didn't really know how to get further than not very far from where they were enslaved, and creating their own colony and living in a place that was so remote that it just wasn't worth it to get them out of there. Many more of those in the Caribbean, but there were some in Louisiana, Florida, and then, as I said, the Great Dismal Swamp. And we see an image here created in the 1800s of a slave, a refugee slave, living in one of these maroon colonies. And then finally, somebody might figure out how they were going to either go north or go south, because they had figured out who would help them and what the possibilities were, where the river would go, and where they might get a train. Although many people, I mean, most of the journeys were on foot, at least for some part of the time, and these are miles and miles and miles, there was a fair amount of number of people who had some kind of boat passage for part of it or some kind of train passage. Of course, the very famous case of Henry Box Brown, who shipped himself in a box to Philadelphia, one of the more creative kinds of things. So people used their imagination, but they were very, very limited by their lack of education. So thinking about it as a series of choices that an individual was making about what the possibilities were is a good way to think about slaves escaping. Back to Harriet Tubman. The more recent biographers have actually found some records of the, call it a plantation, but it was not a huge place, on the eastern shore of Maryland near the Chesapeake Bay, a record of Harriet Tubman's father and mother living in a household, and they eventually had 9 children, of which Harriet, whose given name was Araminta, she was known as Minty. They had 9 children in with the original owner, and then his son ended up with some of the Ben Ross family, her father, and so they ended up in 2 locations in the Chesapeake Bay area. But here's the Patterson Keene Plantation, the Broaddus, the Thompson, all in the neighborhood of what's called Bucktown on the eastern shore of Maryland. If you're not familiar with the eastern shore, Washington is over here somewhere. Here's where Harriet and also Frederick Douglass in this same area on the eastern shore. The eastern shore is much more remote because of the Chesapeake Bay than the rest of Maryland. Of course, we don't have the bridges at this time that there are now, making that simple. But note the proximity to Delaware. which was a free state, and of course, New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And these dots show you some of the roots, the general roots that people like Harriet, who were, that Harriet took as she went back and forth. And you see here the location of the Eastern Shore. One of the things that's important to understand about Harriet Tubman and this area where she was born is that there were a surprising number of free blacks in the area. Maryland and the Upper South had taken a different course than the deeper South area. There were not the huge plantations that we associate with slavery. Because of the changeover from tobacco to timber as a crop, the need for large numbers of slaves had declined over the 1800s in Maryland. And so a lot of people had either freed their slaves, or they had allowed their slaves to buy themselves so that they would be free, or they had agreed to manumit them, to free them at a certain point in time. And so we see the population of free blacks in the Maryland area rising into the 1800s. So this means there are a lot of people in this area that someone like Harriet could communicate with and potentially get help from in terms of moving around this area. Harriet was called Minty. Araminta became Minty, and we're dealing again with Jacob Lawrence's, African-American artist Jacob Lawrence's. He did a couple series in the mid-20th century, of paintings about Harriet Tubman, and this is one of them, one of his, one of the paintings from one of the series, depicting her birth. She was born to Ben Ross and his wife Harriet Ross in this area. She began to be hired out at age 6, and hired out means that her labor was not needed in the home of her master. So he allowed her to go work for someone else, and he got the money for it. So this was a way of making use of your slaves, getting the money for their labor without actually them laboring in your on your actual farm. These were more farms than plantations. She becomes a field hand in her teens, and perhaps the most dramatic thing that happens to her as a young person is this head injury that I think a lot of you are familiar with. She's in a store at one point interacting with a white man and another enslaved person, and there's an argument between the white man and the other person, and she is in the vicinity when the white man throws about a 2-pound weight at the head of the other slave, and it hits her in the head. And so she has a terrific injury, and her biographers believe that she acquired from that injury, and took her a long time to recover, a form of epilepsy called temporal lobe epilepsy. She was already a religious person, but she began to have seizures, suffer headaches that came and went, and also a form of narcolepsy where she would just fall asleep without notice, without even realizing it. In fact, her owner tried to sell her because it took her so long to recover, and they really wondered whether she would be able to function after this injury. But as has happened with a lot of people with this particular injury, her personality and her, particularly her religious fervor, almost seemed to merge with the symptoms of this injury. It's not uncommon for people with this form of epilepsy to have visions. And so Harriet began to sort of see herself as someone who was connected to God in a sense, having these visions that she interpreted as a religious vision. And these were very much a guiding force for her from this time forward. When she was about 20, she's born, we think, in about 1822. She married John Tubman, who was one of the many free blacks in the area. So this was wasn't an unusual move. But it was a big decision because any children that John and Minty at that time would have would be considered her children and therefore slaves. So this is a big decision when you essentially go out and marry someone who is free. She did take the name Harriet at that time. Her mother was Rit Harriet originally, so we think maybe she was honoring her mother there, another Jacob Lawrence image. About 1849, when she was about 26, she picks up information that she thinks her owner is going to sell her. And so she determines that she's going to leave. And she takes off with a couple of her brothers in October of 1849. They get cold feet. And we see here the advertisement for all three of them, Harry, Ben, and Minty. $100 reward offered if they're taken in the state of, $50 if they're taken in the state of Maryland, $100 if out. Her brothers essentially get cold feet, are a little concerned about not knowing the way to north to get to Pennsylvania, to get to Delaware, and they decide to go back, which again was not unusual at all. I mean, what you think is a good idea turns out to be pretty scary when you're out in the dark trying to find your way to a place that you don't even know where it is. So they go back, but Harriet decides on her own shortly thereafter that she is going to take off because she doesn't want to be sold. Two of her siblings have already, her sisters, have been sold south by this owner, and she does not, she's concerned that the family will be split up and completely estranged from each other. She's very concerned about that, and that makes sense in terms of her later actions. So she, because she has been hired out from a young age, she is accessible to this information network. And she picks up the possibility of getting the help of seamen and getting help in Baltimore and finally connecting with what was then known by the 40s as the Underground Railroad, and hooks up with Thomas Garrett, who is the Wilmington Underground Railroad agent, a Quaker. Quakers were often the ones who were, by no means all Quakers, but Quakers were often conductors on the railroad. So with his assistance and many other people's assistance, she is directed into Philadelphia and makes her own escape in late 1849. This is what she is reported to have said. When I found out I had crossed the line, I looked at my hands to see if I was the same person. There was such a glory over everything. Sun came like gold through the trees, over the fields, and I felt like I was in heaven. So at least, if nothing else, we get the sense of her religiosity with this, even if it may not be exactly what she said or thought at the time. Again, we have nothing directly from her, but had a very, very much sense of being, you know, being in the promised land by that time. And of course, another painting by Jacob Lawrence is in 1940, but she talks, Harriet Tubman talked about knowing the North Star, knowing this from her experience on the Eastern Shore, knowing at least that she was going north in that way. She had a great many people helping her along the way, free blacks, as well as by the time she gets north, people like Thomas Garrett. And she finally comes to Philadelphia, where William Still, an African-American, probably the most famous agent of the Underground Railroad, and one of the few who kept records, because it was very dangerous to keep records. And it's his record of the people who came through there, and particularly Harriet. His knowledge has given us most of the knowledge that we have about the Underground Railroad, because there were very few records like that kept. Harriet supposedly talked about feeling that she was a stranger in a strange land, quote from the Bible, and feeling that she was free, but she wanted her family to be free. So that's important to recognize. She wasn't just going back for anybody. Her idea was to go back for her family because she had these brothers and sisters, some of whom had married and had children. So there's a large family network there. You know, we often think about families being split up. In her case, her sisters had been sold, but a lot of the family was still intact in this area. And so she goes back continually in the 1850s, and the best estimate at this point is that she made 13 trips, which is an enormous number of trips in the kind of territory, and she, you know, she could have been captured and sent certainly to jail, but sent back to her owner at any time during this time. But she is able to take mostly family members out, but also sometimes when she goes back on these trips, other people realize she's there and they ask her, they say, oh, we're ready to go, could we go? Sometimes family members decide it's not time for them to go. The choice is no, this is not the right time. I'll have to wait for whatever reason. And she ends up taking another group of people. So she ends up taking 13 trips with various people, but many of them family. And she typically takes various routes, as we noted, up through Maryland and Delaware into Wilmington, typically into Philadelphia, and then either up into New York, Albany, and across New York State, or through a little more dangerous route up to Elmira, through Rochester, and then mostly across what was then a suspension bridge. They would take the train across the suspension bridge into St. Catharines, where there got to be quite a large community of refugees, essentially, escaped slaves. And this was not nirvana for them, although they were legally equal in Canada. They could vote, they could own property, they had a legal equality, but there was still a great deal of discrimination. So we tended to find, at that point, black settlements where they were essentially supporting each other, helping each other out, not only here, but in places like Windsor, across from Detroit, for people that came up through the Ohio network. She did have an involvement with Frederick Douglass, who was from her same area. He lived in Rochester at the time. Many of the other people we associate, Lucretia Mott and her husband, who lived near Philadelphia, were one of the people who sheltered her and the people she came with at some point. So she had involvement even early on with some of the figures that we know. By the late 1850s, she's coming to the end. She's about 40 years old. She's coming to the end of the point where most of her family is out. She has not, her parents actually have become free. They've both been manumitted by this time, by the late 1850s, and she's kind of struggled to get them out as well. Even though they're free, they're a little reluctant to go because they're already free, but she wants the whole family to be together. But she gets involved with relief efforts generally for escaped slaves and begins to, although she first starts to speak privately, she begins to be a public speaker, and she's apparently a very powerful public speaker, presents, she had always very, you know, she's very poor, obviously, so she's presenting in a very, very neat, but, you know, very, very poor clothes. But she has a power that people really respond to. And so she becomes quite a sought-after speaker. In the beginning, at abolitionist events, and later on, after the Civil War, at women's suffrage events as well. She meets John Brown. 1858. There's a wonderful book that came out about a year and a half ago called The Good Lord Byrd. It's fiction, historical fiction, which chronicles the journey of John Brown. But it's very historically accurate, at the same time imaginative, and he does a very nice job with the meeting between Harriet Tubman and John Brown. She meets with him in St. Catharines, where a lot of her family has settled. She never ends up going with him, and nobody really seems to know why. Because she's very supportive of him and raised some money for him. But she never ends up going on the Harper's Ferry raid. But he thought a lot of her. He's the first person to call her general. Other people, because of her insistence on going back into the South at her own risk, tremendous danger, have begun to call her Moses. And we see an image of her, one of the early images of her is from about 1860. Between trips, she raises money to have the money to go and have her expenses on these trips paid for train travel, sea travel, the need for supplies along the way, the need for clothing to replace the clothing that the people coming out are in. So she's working as a cook. She's working as a domestic sometimes. She works in Cape May. Any of you know New Jersey, Cape May? Very tip of New Jersey, Philadelphia, she works. She's also raising money by these speaking engagements. If you know anything about the Finger Lakes area of New York, you know that the suffrage movement begins there. One of the first big suffrage meetings starts there in Seneca Falls, New York, just south of Rochester. there were a lot of people in that area who were involved in abolition, in suffrage, and in Auburn, New York, which is just east of Seneca Falls, William Seward, who was in the Lincoln administration. You may remember that name, Seward's Folly, the purchase of Alaska. But Harriet Tubman, he was a great supporter of Harriet Tubman, and she ends up settling after the Civil War in Auburn, New York, on the outskirts of New York, and he sells her some property that he owned and goes into kind of a long-term mortgage arrangement with her. And you see on the left here, it looks like it's the brick home. Originally a frame dwelling that she lived in that burns down about in the 1860s and is replaced with a brick dwelling, which is still there today. I'm happy to say that I had the opportunity to go to Auburn this summer and was able to see this. So she settles on this land that eventually includes this house and another larger home, which ends up to be a home for the aged because she's concerned about people who can't do for themselves. So she's always thinking about somebody else, it seems, raising money to either help her family or help other people who are essentially refugees. And this is another image into the 1870s of her in the Auburn area. But even after she's made these trips, she is almost not really conscripted, I wouldn't say. But during the Civil War, the governor of Massachusetts has heard of her fame, has heard of the kinds of things she has done. And everybody that reports about her talks about her fearlessness, how she was utterly fearless. Even though she was quite a small woman and obviously had these huge health issues, but utterly fearless. And the governor talks her into essentially becoming a soldier and going down to Beaufort, South Carolina, near Fort Sumter, where the Civil War had recently essentially begun. And she becomes kind of a scout as well as a cook, as well as a nurse in that area there as the Civil War is just beginning. And we see this very famous image that's taken about this time. An important thing to remember is she was handed the gun when this image was taken. So the gun was not her choice. She did carry a gun when she went into the South. She did carry a gun because, you know, she famously said, "I never lost a passenger." Well, she never lost a passenger because she never allowed anyone to go back. If they wanted to go back, if they were losing their courage, she pulled out the gun, said, "You're not going back." So she never had to do that, apparently. But the gun was just to let people know we're serious, we're going forward. And she couldn't afford to let anybody go back because of the danger of them communicating what the other people were doing. So she did carry a gun. I don't know how often she used it. Nobody knows that. But the gun was put in her hand for this image. So she becomes a war spy and a scout. She becomes the first woman to lead a raid, the Combahee River. She had scouted out this area in South Carolina, and she ends up bringing in a lot of what they then called contraband, a lot of slaves who were in the South who had been declared, Lincoln hadn't declared this yet, were essentially declared free by the Union officer in that area. And she, because of her scouting expertise, was able to play a key role in that raid in 1863. I guess I didn't mention that she went back for her husband at one point. A couple years after she had made herself free, she finds out he was free, of course, from the beginning. She finds out that he had married again. And she apparently makes a joke about this at one of her meetings, talks about, you know, she took these clothes for him to run away with, and then she found out that he was married again. And so she apparently made a joke at it. I mean, he said, "Well, I had the clothes, but I didn't have him." So she kind of had no choice there. He was not interested in coming away. He was a free black. He decided he was better off where he was. But she did end up, when she was in Auburn, marrying Nelson Davis, who was a Civil War vet, about 20 years younger than she was, quite disabled, apparently. So it's unclear why she married him. But in 1869, she marries him. Her fame is, by this time, with all these meetings that she's talking at and just people reporting on her exploits, begins to spread. There is an article during the early 60s about her in the Boston newspaper, people getting interested in writing her life story. The first biography appears in 68, and is reprinted a couple times in the next 30, 40 years. She has a big, big issue getting paid for all this work she did, essentially as a soldier during the Civil War. Finally gets back pay and kind of a pension in 1899. But she's just really dirt poor all her life and is either working or trying to raise money to help the people that she's taken in on her homestead and to just keep herself and her family going. And we see an image here about the 1890s of her, and this is the last year of her life. She dies in 1913, is in a wheelchair for the last 3 years. And I never did find her gravesite. I went into the cemetery in Auburn and I did not find her gravesite. It was not well marked. But she is buried in Auburn, lived a very long life, and a rather worthwhile one, I would think we could agree on. So that's a very quick run through a lot about Harriet Tubman.
We've reached the best part of the episode, the Q&A with our audience at Merriam Park Library on October 13th, 2015. For the sake of clarity, I've transcribed the audience's questions and will read them. The first question is about Harriet Tubman's family life. Do we know if she had any children along the way?
Well, that's an interesting question. The biographer Kate Clifford Larson, whose biography is the one that I recommend of the three recent ones, and by the way, she just came out with this book about Rosemary Kennedy. But she speculates there's this young woman who's called a niece that is in Tubman's family in Auburn, and she's always described as a niece, but Larson speculates that it might be a daughter that she had out of wedlock, or unclear where and when she would have had it, but she speculates that maybe that woman was her daughter. So other than that, we don't know. Again, speculating, but the fact that her husband, her John, was free, she was not free, they may have hesitated to have children because those children would be enslaved.
The second question references a map of the Underground Railroad system Professor Zonheiser mentions earlier in the presentation. Just a quick reminder that you can download that presentation at thefriends.org/courage. Professor Zonheiser notes that many slaves actually headed south, not north. Where in the South was considered safe for escaped slaves?
Well, as I said, New Orleans, if you were in the Deep South area, New Orleans was a great place, a large city where it was easy to disappear because of the number of free blacks already. So that was one place. Leaving the country, just getting on a boat, if you were down in this area, getting on a boat and going to the Caribbean or anywhere you could land to was another possibility. In the Deep South, again, these maroon colonies where you were just going off into the wilderness. And there was a big one, North Carolina, Virginia, right in this area, the Great Dismal Swamp. And in Louisiana and Georgia, I think, is the other state where, Florida, where you've got enough really remote territory, like in, you know, the Okefenokee, is that it? The big swampland in Florida, where it just wasn't worth it to come in and get you. And so we have those kinds of communities. But also smaller towns were a possibility. There weren't as many enslaved people that escaped from the Deep South just because of those difficulties. You could go west, but it was difficult. I mean, you don't have the waterways going west unless you go up in the Missouri. The Mississippi River, of course, potentially could carry you up into Illinois, even up into Minnesota or Iowa. So that was another possibility.
Following that last question, an audience member asked if any slaves attempted to escape to Florida.
Well, Florida was part of the U.S. Yeah, they went to Florida to hide out. You know, Florida has the same kind of history as New Orleans, held by the Spanish, held by the French, so it was maybe a little different situation, but it was a slave state, and there was the very large maroon colony, but no, it wasn't known as a huge plantation state, very different locale environment, so you don't have the large plantations.
Next up, an audience member asks if there is any evidence that Harriet Tubman learned to read and write later in life.
Don't have any evidence of that. I mean, she was really 40 by the time she would have had the opportunity to do that. There's nothing in Larson's book to indicate that was a big aim of her. She was really, you read the description of what she's doing, she's always traveling, going to a meeting to raise money or going to check on her family. She does eventually bring her parents out, so she's concerned with them for, you know, a good part of time after the Civil War until they die. So she seems to see herself as kind of the protector, not only the liberator, but also the protector of all of these people that she's brought out. So she takes on an enormous amount of responsibility. So to our knowledge, she never learns how to read or write. So, unfortunately for us, because we don't have anything directly from her, which is a real loss. You know, Frederick Douglass got his autobiography and letters and tons of stuff from him, but nothing from her.
Following that question, an audience member asked about Harriet Tubman's role in the women's suffrage movement. Did she have much involvement in that movement?
Like the abolition movement, particularly after the Civil War, she gets involved with, of course, she'd already been involved with Lucretia Mott, who's a big suffragist. But after the Civil War, she meets in that same area as Auburn. Rochester is not very far away. Susan B. Anthony lived in Rochester, although she was also an inveterate traveler. So she does meet Susan B. Anthony, calls Susan B. Anthony a friend, and she does begin to appear, like Sojourner Truth does, at some of the women's suffrage meetings and speaking up for the right of suffrage for women. So most of her involvement seems to be as a speaker at suffrage meetings.
Next up, an audience member asked Professor Zonheiser to clarify her comment earlier about Tubman receiving back pay from the U.S. government. Tubman received a pension in 1899, but what was the pension for?
Yes. Yeah, the whole back pay thing involved a lot of her time. She was essentially a soldier when she was working for the Union Army. She was a cook, she was a nurse, she was a scout. So she spent 2 or 3 years down in South Carolina, full-time, if not more than full-time, working for them, and was essentially never paid for that work. So afterwards, she applied for a pension, and she had a lot of trouble getting that. She was eventually awarded, before she got anything for herself, after her second husband died, she eventually got a widow's pension for him of $8, which amounts to about $200 in today's dollars, in 1888. Finally, in 1899, she gets a $500 lump sum for her service, plus another $20 a month, which is considered a pension and the back pay. So it took her 1899, so it took her almost 30 years to get that. The explanation for the length of time was how difficult it was because of the really inadequate records to verify things, particularly about the identity of people who were formerly enslaved. That's one of the problems, although 30 years, I don't know that excuses it.
Finally, an audience member asks about the final years of Harriet Tubman's life. Who took care of her in her later years?
Well, by this time, she has nieces and nephews and great-nieces and great-nephews. And so she's really surrounded. A lot of her family has, after the Civil War, comes into that Auburn area. And she also has, of course, William Seward has died by this time, but his extended family, his daughters and sons, also continue to take an interest in her to make sure she's well cared for. So a combination, I think, of family and the friends that she had really all over Auburn, including the Sewards. Sewards were still a big presence in Auburn. All right. Well, thank you very much for your attention. If you have questions you'd like to ask me privately, feel free. There are a few books, the books that I mentioned, the Larson biography. There is a terrific book by very prominent historian Eric Foner about the New York City network of Underground Railroad helpers. This is based on information that has just been discovered. Everybody always thought the William Still Diary was kind of it in terms of detailed information. And then a graduate student of Eric Foner's wondered about this document that she found at Columbia and turned out to be another detailed record of what was going on in New York City. So he's talking about the New York City Underground Railroad for the first time, which is kind of amazing. So that book just came out this year. Fergus Bordovich's book came out a couple years ago, very accessible. Talks a lot about the Ohio network and Levi Coffin, who lived across the river from Kentucky. The other book that is not on your reading list that I would mention, if you're interested in this area of Maryland and the particular environment in terms of slavery where there were a lot of free blacks, the novel The Known World by Edward Jones that came out 10 or 15 years ago now, a wonderful book that really gives you an image of a very different kind of slavery than the plantation kind of thing that we all imagine. Maryland was the Upper South was very different in terms of the environment for slavery. The Known World, wonderful book of fiction that's very historically accurate in terms of this area. Thank you very much. I hope to see you next week.
You've been listening to Friendly Connections, the podcast of the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider supporting the Friends and its mission, Stronger Libraries for Stronger Communities. Learn more at thefriends.org. For more episodes, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or visit thefriends.org/podcast. Thank you again for listening.